Welcome to this special edition of Free Thoughts. My name is John Samples. I'm Vice President at the Cato Institute. James Madison Jr. was born on March 16th, 1751, 269 years ago. And he was an American statesman and a founding father who served as the fourth president of the United States from 1809 to 1817. He is hailed as the father of the Constitution for his pivotal role in drafting and promoting the United States Constitution. He was a member of the Constitutional Convention and took the notes on its activities that continue to our day to inform, say, the Supreme Court or citizens' interpretation of the Constitution. He also drafted the United States Bill of Rights. His last amendment finally became part of the Constitution on May 7th, 1992, that is when Bill Clinton was running for president, after having been rejected in the early 1790s. Madison also co-wrote the Federalist Papers. Federalist 10, among others, is considered one of the major works of political theory that the United States has produced. He co-founded the Democratic-Republican Party, which we can discuss whether what kind of forerunner it is to one of our parties today. And he served as the fifth United States Secretary of State from 1801 to 1809. Today, I will be discussing Madison with Michael B. Levy, who holds a PhD in political theory and who has for more than 30 years worked in and around Congress and also held high executive office. Also, we will be talking with Gene Healy, Vice President at the Cato Institute, who has written widely on executive power, including his book, The Cult of the Presidency, and now writing The Indispensable Remedy, subtitled The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Cato Institute. Mike, Madison was a legislator and a pretty good one. You've had a lot of experience with Congress. What would Madison say about our current Congress and everything that goes with it and what people say about it?
Well, he was a politician. He was a theorist. He was a statesman. And he was, of course, a member of the legislature. And I think he would probably, like all legislators, say something different when he needed to say something different. But in general, I think he would say a couple of things, and they may not seem consistent, but I think they are. I think the first thing he would say is, we did a pretty good job in creating a system of separations of powers and checks and balances, and many of the things I was most frightened of, that we would have a demagogue that would arise into power, a sort of a populist monarch. We've solved some of those problems and on some of those occasions stopped it. We've stopped some of the worst local movements from becoming national movements. And we've done a pretty good job of protecting individual rights, both of property and of religious liberty and of speech. And the Congress has played its role in all of that. I think he would say he's a little surprised that they give away some of their constitutional authority. Perhaps it would be an interesting thing to look at war powers. But as I said, he's a statesman and he spent a lot of time in his life seeing erosions of that even in his own lifetime and then participating in it to some extent when in the War of 1812. So I think he would be pleased. I think the other thing he would have to comment on, and he began to see this in his own life, of course, is that the representation of place, you know, I'm from the such and such district of so and so, and that's who I've come here to represent, has in many ways eroded, and you have more and more people who see themselves as members of the Republican Party or members of the Democratic Party, and their first thought is toward their primary election in their state and not necessarily the interests that define their state or their region. Now, I don't want to overstate that position because I just have overstated it. But I think while he did see the evolution of parties and himself was instrumental, as you said, in founding one of the parties, I think he would probably be a little, if not surprised, I think he would be a little at least cognizant of the fact that what he describes in the Federalist Papers and what actually goes on a day-to-day basis in the contemporary Congress are a little bit different.
Gene, on the presidency, you've written a lot about it. What do you think Madison would think about the presidency? I remember what Mike just said reminded me one time you said to me, you know, we would go and talk to members, or we would give, Gene would give testimony about the war powers. And I remember Gene saying, it's so weird. We always have to go up there trying to get them to do their job that's clear and try to get them to exercise their power. They're like, Madison was expected them to be, that wasn't going to be a problem, exercising power. The problem was stopping them from doing that, right? What do you think about the presidency? And particularly, you've just written on impeachment. Was Madison, how would he think we're talking impeachment now? And we have been throughout much of our adult lives at various times. What would he think about that?
Well, you know, Madison was concerned that you know, the legislature was where the danger was, principally, you know, drawing all power into its impetuous vortex, which seems kind of quaint today, given where we are with the powers that have accrued to the presidency. But he was also he was cognizant of the risks that the presidency could present. He wasn't naive to that. My paper on impeachment, Indispensable Remedy, the title is from, you know, it's an adjective that both Madison and Mason used to describe the remedy of impeachment. And I structure a lot of the paper around what Madison said at the convention. He said it was indispensable, being able to remove the president midterm was indispensable, you know, for, among other things, the incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the chief magistrate. And I structure a lot of the paper around that. He wanted, he interpreted what came out of the Constitution, eventually high crimes and misdemeanors per Mason. He interpreted that pretty broadly. And unlike there's a contemporary argument where you have to be especially wary of presidential impeachments because there's only one man in the office. You know, you get rid of a federal judge, we've got hundreds of other federal judges who can step in, but it's particularly weighty when it comes to this office that is at the top is one single man. Madison actually thought that the dangers from the singularity of the office cut the other way. He at the convention, he says that, you know, incapacity or corruption in other branches is not as concerning. You can't assume that everybody in Congress is going to lose their capacity or be bribed at once, and you can't assume that the whole judiciary is going to go bad. But he says that the presidency is occupied by a single man, and malfeasance in that office could be, quote, fatal to the republic. So he definitely saw impeachment as a key remedy. And given his concern about the concentration of war powers, you know, his statements to the effect that there's no danger to public liberty as grand as in war, in part because of the concentration of power in the executive, I think he would be, well, after he got over being catatonic and flabbergasted by smartphones and cars, when he got around to looking at government, the way the federal government operates, I think he would be quite concerned about the way in which, particularly after 9/11, war has become a permanent backdrop of the conduct of federal affairs. It's no longer a departure from a baseline of peace. It's the new norm.
But it, just as a aside, I mean, yes, I think I would agree with all of that. But Madison was generally is viewed as being a depending of a poor to average president, but a superior kind of constitution writer and also a superior legislator. And he did seem to have the sort of spirit of the legislator, and he thought legislators were very important. Is that a fair thing historically, you think? Was he that poor a president?
Well, to some extent, I'll defer to Gene, but I think he was a better president than he's given credit for. He's often seen as a bumbling president because of the way he began the War of 1812. And it's interesting, given our conversation, in part that's because he relied heavily on militias, didn't want to use a standing government, was reluctant to build a strong navy, and he himself was a member of a militia. His father was a member of a militia. I think he believes that was an important part of being a Republican citizen, mm-hmm. of having the spirit of liberty in your soul. And so I think he took some of that for granted. And I think he also was terrified a large standing army with a strong executive would be something like a European tyrant. But what he found over time, and this to his credit, he needed more disciplined, organized troops that wouldn't go home to plow fields and wouldn't care more about what the interests of Michigan were versus the interests of the United States or, you know, wherever, because he was going into Canada at one point of the war above Detroit. And I think so. I think in the end, he's a consequential president in part because of his evolution and the country's evolution over time. Not a great president, but he is a great American and a great American thinker, and he confronts all of the great issues of our day. And I would say, somewhat like Jimmy Carter, he's an interesting post-president.
You know, I actually looked this up before we got started to see where Madison was in the historical rankings, and what I recalled it was somewhere in the top half in these surveys they give to, political scientists and historians. Those surveys are usually a very poor guide to who was a good president in terms of, some of the things we care about at Cato.
That's right.
But he's on the latest serious one, the American Political Science Association survey from last year. Madison clocks in at number 12, which, I agree, he wasn't one of our worst presidents, but this does make you think that these surveys, even among scholars, have more to do with celebrity than actual achievement. I mean, after all, the White House and the Capitol get set on fire in Madison's term, which is not something that it does seem to be the historical reputation. And the ranking as president does seem to be borrowing some from his reputation as a legislator and a constitution maker.
That reminds me of something I was thinking about Federalist 10 in Congress when Mike was speaking before. If you look at that Federalist 10 and his plans to sort of make popular government work, there's a real strong sense that he believed in elites. Remember, the whole point of Federalist 10 is to say he's trying to argue against direct democracy because that's what people think of when they think about republicanism, right? So he's saying, have these institutions and you can refine the people's will and it'll work out better rather than direct voting because that's caused all kinds of problems in various places at various times. But that sort of fits to our world today where you have this strong sense that our elites are very much in a bad odor. They've caused all the problems. And the Madisonian ideal that they could somehow be anything other than the enemy of the people is really kind of out of our attention at this point. It's something people aren't really buying, right? But Madison, it's very much the representative and the person in Congress or any kind of indirect voting. He approves of all these kinds of indirect voting. He says electing the president is an indirect vote, and that's a good thing, right? So in a sense, isn't Madison a man of another era? He's Andrew Jackson, or you could say, he's like a founding father. They were too elitist. We've become a different country now. What do you think?
Well, you could say that.
You could say anything, Mike.
That's true. And you would be right to some extent. He was not a thoroughgoing egalitarian. He wouldn't satisfy certain people's standards without a doubt. But the fact of the matter is that I think Madison trusts nobody. It's not that he trusts elites and he distrusts masses. He trusts nobody. He's afraid that an undifferentiated mass will be occasionally mob-like and will want to take the property and just deserts of hardworking people and destroy them. And you know, in Federalist 10, he talks about one of the examples is a rage for paper money.
Mm-hmm.
He's terrified of that. He's seen it already during the Articles of Confederation. He believes that if you give too much power and authority to the wealthy, they will abuse people who don't have property or who have little bits of property. If you give too much power to the landed, they'll abuse people who are moving into the commercial areas. So I think he is, in many ways, a pre-Jacksonian who over time, later in life, becomes much more of a Jacksonian. By that I mean he's quite interested in expanding the suffrage and of getting people who have little bits of property the right to vote, at least to vote for the House of Representatives or to vote for the legislative bodies in their states, and ultimately to get as broad a suffrage as he thinks is plausible. So he toys actually with universal manhood suffrage later in his life. At the convention, his notes suggest that he's more interested in that for the states than he is for the House of Representatives. But even in the House of Representatives, he's very interested in a very broad suffrage, and he thinks if you have a small bit of property, that will qualify you for that vote. And so he does. He has sort of we talk about a system of checks and balance and separation of powers, but I think he also has a system of maybe filtration where you sort of, as you go up and up and up, the masses speak one way, and then indirect voting, sort of they cool the saucer that cools the cup kind of thing that you hear often described for the Senate. So I think Madison is in many ways trying to take the mixed government of the British, the monarchy, the aristocracy, and the commons, and the commons member don't have anything close to universal manhood suffrage, and to make that a more egalitarian version in the United States with no hereditary power. So I think to underestimate both his egalitarianism and his majoritarianism is wrong, but he's not. His instincts aren't modern in that regard.
Well, this reminds me of something I was reading for this in Federalist 39, to go back to the impeachment. He really treats impeachment in Federalist 39 as a kind of Republican institution in that it holds office holders accountable. So there's nothing of him, to go to your point, is the president is this person that is free and able to carry out whatever some great good is, right? It's part of the Republican nature of the new Constitution, which he believes it has to be Republican. It's not an aristocracy. It's not a monarchy. It has to be Republican. The impeachment is part of that, and he's keen to show that, you know, the new government is going to do better than actually the states do, because some of the states don't have means of impeaching their governors. So I think that goes to that question. Yeah, he's trying to figure out how you can have sort of an important role for elites that make things better, though. And so maybe it's the difference between now everyone, this general view that elites always make things a lot worse, right? And his view that it could be different. You could actually he's an institutionalist. You design the system so people's incentives lead you to good conclusions.
Yeah, I think that's his goal. I mean, he talks about ambition counteracting ambition. He doesn't talk about virtue and enlightenment, even though he does elsewhere talk about those things a little bit, and I'm sure you want to talk about that. But he's really quite cynical that you can ever give power to someone and they will over a long period of time exercise it beautifully and in the public's interest. So you have to constantly make sure every interest is reasonably represented and then let them go at it more or less.
Which is kind of weird, because there was one person, I would argue, that actually comes close to that, which was Washington himself. I mean, to me, it's completely inexplicable that Washington doesn't go the way of all flesh and become a Caesar, right?
Because Washington is a thoroughgoing Republican. So Cincinnatus is the model, right? The Roman who goes back to farm. And that's what Washington does. He says two terms. It's not in the Constitution. It doesn't come until amendment form much, much later, and after Franklin Roosevelt and after Harry Truman. So he voluntarily leaves. And he sets the precedent that this is a rotating office, in essence. And he does so because of his Republican values and his sense of civic virtue.
Mm-hmm. So is that the part about impeachment and Republicanism? Is that your sense too, Gene, that that's basically pretty important for him? It's part of the the Republican nature of the institution, which would really, I mean, we're sort of treating it like we've got to kind of like a, you know, a special move we've got to make to go outside the Constitution. And the idea in Federalist Paper 39 seems to be, oh, this is part of the story. This is part of the way you constrain rulers, and it's also the part of the way you have popular government.
Yeah, you know, the framers, Madison included, were not nearly as angsty about the possibility of impeachment as we've grown over the years. Ironically, as the presidency has become more and more powerful, we've sort of enshrined it with more and more protections, including this cultural superstition surrounding impeachment, that it's a patricide, it's a you know, just one of the most awful and soul-wrenching things you can engage in. They didn't want it used cavalierly, but Madison, you know, Madison often gets cited, the exchange he has with Mason, that the constitutional language in Article 2, Section 4, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, comes out. Madison gets cited because of this exchange where he objected to Mason's addition of maladministration to the proposed causes of impeachment. Madison gets cited as somebody who's an impeachment skeptic, and I think that's wrong. You know, both at the convention and later on in the first Congress, when there's a historic debate about, you know, the removal power, should the president only be able to remove cabinet officers by the same means with which they're appointed, or should he be able to just fire a cabinet officer? During that debate, you know, the objection is raised, well, you know, what if the president goes around getting rid of good people and, you know, just wantonly? And Madison says, well, if he does that, he could be impeached for such an act of maladministration, the wanton removal of meritorious officers. So that's a, you know, pretty broad view of the impeachment power. He fires somebody that's good, he can be turfed out.
There's another aspect of this, which is, I think of Madison, I think of the legislator and the Constitution person. Well, by the way, a brilliant sort of guy, right? He, 3 years before the Constitution, he sees it coming. He goes and studies, gets ready for it. He gets there early. He's just, it's like total strategic genius, right? I'm going to become famous here, folks. I see my option. But, you know, he was a legislator, and I think he expected, and many of them expected from Congress, that these guys would be, you know, they would have a sense of the congressional role and Congress's place, and it might actually be the dominant role. They might feel themselves that way. And the thing I notice is, like, take the Libya thing that Gene and I talked a lot about at the time, is that, and the War Powers Resolution.
I mean, you talk about it in the Obama administration.
In the Obama administration, but you could talk about any number of these kinds of things in the last 50 years or so. You don't sense this business about ambition being against ambition, branch against branch, and fighting it out. You sense that Congress, like, doesn't have a strong – members of Congress don't have a strong view of themselves as, like, I'm a member of Congress, and damn it, I'm not going to put up with this. You have a sense that they – that's too much responsibility. What do you think about it? Is this wrong, or do you think they have a –
Well, I think you're partially right. I think without a doubt they often want to get it off their hands, and they'd rather the executive do it. You really saw that during the debate over whether we should intervene in Syria or not. The Congress was like, I don't want to do this. You know, you guys are – you know, and then would just go and engage in demagogic speeches on all sides and talk about Benghazi or something rather than confront what was their responsibility. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, as over time there is an evolution of the president's war-making powers. And I would add that there's an evolution of when wars end and when there is peace. But Madison saw it in his own time. So, you know, Jefferson takes on the Barbary power, the pirates. Yeah. And that's the precedence that's used by Truman in Korea to call it a police action and avoid a declaration. And Congress does step in and create the War Powers Act. And the War Powers Act purposefully gives the president a certain amount of time, because unlike in Madison or Jefferson's time or Washington's time, you know, we don't have a buffer of oceans against powerful countries. We have troops in Europe. We have troops that we have to get to the Far East. We have you know, emergency things in Taiwan and places like that. You know, during
we
have far flung interests. So we might argue it's an empire. We might argue that we're defending freedom everywhere. Maybe both, but whatever it is. You don't have necessarily a week to debate these things sometimes. And more importantly, perhaps, your adversaries have to know that you can react immediately, that if a tripwire hits in Europe against NATO, we're automatically in. If there's a tripwire in the Straits of Taiwan, we're automatically in. And that may help keep the peace. So regardless of whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, Congress itself is now evolving to a different situation. And perhaps the analogy of their time was, how do you respond to Indians? Because we were in a long, many hundreds year war against Indians, and we don't like to describe it that way because Native Americans are our citizens. But at the time, it wasn't viewed that way, and they weren't citizens. And we were, at the time of the Constitution, there were Indian wars being fought on southern borders and western borders. So I think that was usually responded to by local militias rather than the federal government. So the federal government has to all of a sudden deal with, over time, the fact that we have shrinking protection from the oceans. And I think these are decisions that are made over a long period of time. The erosion is not immediate. I mean, Gene knows this stuff much better than I do, so I would defer to him. But I do think that it's not illogical. But what happens, if you're not an active citizen, you're a weak citizen, Congress has lost its chops.
There has been a movement, a much stronger movement, away from Congress and away from the states than Madison would have expected, and toward the courts and toward go on.
I don't want to get too deep in the weeds and too far from Madison, but that's not how I read the War Powers Resolution. I mean, it has been used on occasion to make the claim that it gives the president a 60-day pass to wage war. That's not even what the Office of Legal Counsel has said in supporting presidential wars. And the resolution itself, you know, I'm sure, you know, it, like anything with legislative history, people had different intentions and goals in voting for it. But the resolution itself may have been a mistake because it sets up that claim, but it specifically says it doesn't give the president any power he doesn't already have by constitution or statute, and it lists the causes for waging war without Congress, and they're pretty limited. So the idea that the War Powers Resolution was in essence designed to empower Panamas and Libyas and Kosovos, I don't think it is consistent with the text, but I think it does point up how, in many ways, at least in the 20th and 21st century, what Madison envisioned as sort of a self-executing architecture where the interests of the man are connected to the constitutional rights of the place, and everybody in each branch has the incentive to, you're not depending on their goodwill. They have an incentive to guard their turf from encroachments by the other branches. It's worked out really well for the presidency because I think the incentives really do line up there. The presidents want to leave the office at least as strong as they found it. They have an interest while they're in office in doing that. But individual Congress people have a main interest in getting reelected, and it's pretty rare that we punish anybody who, nobody lost their seat over signing on to too broad a resolution 3 days after September 11th. Mm-hmm. You did have a couple of Democratic senators who'd voted for the Iraq War resolution, and in 2008, had some difficulty explaining their votes. But in general, we don't punish legislators who punt the big questions of war and peace and the laws we live under. And I think that is possibly a flaw in the Madisonian design.
Well, let me give you another example that Mike will know a lot more about than I do, but it seemed to me as an outsider, this was what happened. And I'm talking about the financial crisis of 2008.
I was an outsider at the time, thank God.
As you recall, the Congress was called upon to provide money for bailing out the banks. And it was right at the end of September, early October. Of course, it was a crisis atmosphere. And had a very hard time getting them to vote for that. And they finally came up with the votes after about a week and several failures and about three
right. Several failures.
Several weeks before it was about a month before Election Day. But what they ultimately ended up with beyond that was, they delegated a lot of authority. A lot of it was to the Fed and to – and I was stunned in reading it back as you went on down through November and December to find that members of Congress were actually ended up kind of playing lobbyists, trying to affect the distribution of the money with the Treasury rather than – acting as people who were appropriators and taking responsibility for that. And so you had this sort of flipping of the responsibilities where Treasury, including Bernanke and Treasury Secretary, were willing to take the responsibility, but they also took the power too. And it had this sort of basic congressional power of appropriation had been given away, kind of delegated, and then they came back and you run on saying, well, I got so much money to bail out the banks in my district, which was kind of a lobbyist for your district with a third branch of government. It seemed like – now, you can argue that all of this was kind of – or maybe it all should have been done by the Fed. It was ultimately almost all done by the Fed anyway. But it seemed like a bizarre – you put the whole system under pressure and you end up finding it's perverted at those levels, the distribution of powers.
Well, that wasn't the first time. The precedent for that was the Resolution Trust Corporation, which where I was. I came in the mop-up action. I was in the Clinton administration. Bush had initiated it. We did the last part. And what was fascinating there, to speak of Congress, is that congressmen would vote for the reappropriation of the money. The RTC would then figure out what to do with it.
Right.
But once banks or savings and loans, in this case, went under resolution in specific districts, the members would vote against it the next time.
Hmm.
And you'd say, but Congressman, you voted, you know, we still have a third of the job left to do, and you voted for it last time. Why are you voting against it now? I said, well, that was then, and this is now, and the banks in my district have gone under resolution, and it's politically unpopular, so now I'm going to vote against it. And I think to put it mildly, self-interested, but one of the problems when you create a mechanistic system, and I support it, but it's a mechanistic system that assumes everyone's self-interested, it doesn't demand that there be something other than self-interested.
Well, that brings me to another point that seems that you've nicely shown is not as abstract as I thought it was, which is that, you know, Madison and his generation are really, they have a sense of what republicanism, what we would call a democratic government, a government of the people is. And they're thinking about Italian city-states, or they're thinking about the Greek small direct democracies, right? And they're also thinking that one of those attributes of those early democracies is that, you know, Aristotle and to a certain extent Plato's telling you, you got for people to make this work, there's got to be a lot of civic virtue. These people have to be restrained, or they have to be devoted to the common good, or various kinds of ideas like this, right? And they're looking at the United States in 1789 and saying, you know, it's a gigantic thing of 13 colonies already, and it's going to get bigger probably, and you really can't, you got to have a monarchy, not a And if you try to set up a republic, it'll just break down really quickly. So Madison's answer to that is the size of the thing works for its good. You split up the majorities that might be tyrannical, but also it's an institutional. You design the Constitution in such a way as to get the incentives right. And it does sound like, as you say, one interpretation is it's purely mechanical. He's totally going by the boards. He says, we don't need morality. We don't need civic virtue. We can, through this Enlightenment idea, we can design the institution in such a way as the thing will work without civic virtue, because you can't count on that. People sort of, you know, too self-interested or whatever. Is that true about Madison? Is he saying sort of like, people are devils, but look, you could get the institutions in such a way that you'll end up not only raising GNP and your you can, greed is good in that sense, and then on the other side, it's okay also in politics. Is that his position? And is it actually a false position? You need some kind of civic virtue from folks.
So I don't think it's his position. I think his position is probably a little closer to what I think is the right position on this question. But Madison, without a doubt, is not obsessed with virtue. Typically, theorists of republicanism, even in the early republic, Gordon Wood wrote a wonderful book called The Creation of the American Republic, and he has a whole chapter on Christian Sparta. And he talks about the ideal of having a small, Spartan-like city-state of religious people and so on and so forth. Madison knows that literature. He knows that the ideal is the yeoman farmer and the who farms his own land. It's a he. He has a family, but it's the male head of household. He participates in the militia. He gives himself over to the common good as a citizen in local government, and he learns public spiritedness through that. And Madison realizes a couple of things. First of all, it doesn't always work that way. He's now been around government too long. And he sees that, in fact, in smaller republics, the states, you can have factions that come to power very quickly and are very destructive. Mm. In addition to that, and this is an interesting thing about Madison that's not talked about much, Madison lives in a county where there are a lot of Baptists. And he always gets the Baptist vote. So he becomes a huge defender of separation of church and state in some broad sense, at least freedom of religion, and against the establishment church as a monopoly church. And in addition to that, he's read Montesquieu, who's spent a lot of time talking about these issues. Montesquieu grapples with what is the commercial republic as opposed to the agricultural republic. He's been to Princeton. He studied with Witherspoon, who's a student of Adam Smith. So he knows that we are dramatically changing as a civilization and a society, and we're moving toward a commercial republic, which is going to multiply interests. Everybody's not going to be a farmer with the same crop, so we're going to have multiple competing interests. So the stuff of our republic is going to be different. And so it's not that we don't need people who are public-spirited. You used the example of Washington. Who could be better? It's not that wise men aren't important. Mm-hmm. It's not that we don't want to cull out sort of nature's aristocrats and as much as possible use them in government because there'll be other interested and care about the common good. It's that we can't depend on that always being what right. governs us. And a dependence on that and a dependence only on if something like socialization or education or character building would be a huge mistake. We would lose the republic before we got very far along.
So there's a quote here that I came across again that was, this is from the Federalist in 1788. Madison writes, "There is a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust. So there are also other qualities in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence. Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities, that is, the virtuous qualities, in higher degree than any other form." And then he goes on to say, if you did not have this virtue among men, they could not have self-government. There has to be some level. So he's not a complete cynic and or a Hobbesian that's working. He sees both sides here. And I think that's sort of what makes him kind of less of a famous political theorist. Famous political theorists usually take one side of it and put Hobbes, for example, or somebody else more altruistic, right?
Where they're the easiest ones to teach in political theory class.
But
I think Madison tries very hard to say what is Republican self-government. It does, over the long haul, require public spiritedness, but you can't depend on it, and you're going to have times when it's incredibly threatened, and you need to have a lot of these mechanisms that take the stuff of the polity, which is self-interested individuals, for granted and create enough mechanisms to control for them.
Let's stay on this and go to our day once again, which is this, and this comes into Gene's area. There were a lot of conservatives, or maybe not a lot, but a few conservatives, when Donald Trump became clear that he was going to win the nomination, that revolted. And part of the revolt was on this issue, right? That, we've been running around talking about virtue and statesmanship for quite a while now. And this guy's the exact opposite of that. That was their argument. And so he's not really a conservative in that sense. And we, having made our position, can't support him. And they did that with the expectation that the Republican primary voters felt similar or had bought those arguments in the past. That is, it was an argument about a certain sense of virtue, maybe even more, maybe a Christian Spartan version in some versions, but it was certainly something like that. And the response that came back, including some from some conservatives, was, yeah, don't worry about that. The virtue is not the whole thing. This guy is basically, you know, he can win. He's not the other candidate. And if he wins, we can hold him to the abortion decision, or we can hold him or the abortion position, or we can hold him to appoint people to the court that would be good people for the court. So it was kind of, instead of electing the man who's going to have a lot of discretion and needs to be virtuous, is an idea that, well, he's better than the other choice because the other choice is horrible, and we can hold him to it. We don't need virtue in him. We can need incentives. We can incentivize him properly, right? Is that correct, or am I off track here?
I was just thinking of one of Madison's predictions that didn't work out, as well as some of the others from Federalist 10, that an extended republic would make it difficult for unworthy candidates to practice with success the vicious arts by which elections are too often carried. So I don't know if that holds true today. Trump as a as an example, the question is, Trump as an example of someone who does not have whatever residuum of Republican virtue Madison envisioned, but is still checked. To a certain extent, things could be a lot worse than they are. You do see some serious pushback from various institutions to any attempts that Trump has made to expand the powers of the presidency. I'd say surprisingly, there haven't been as many attempts as you would expect from the rhetoric. The rhetoric is very imperial. Very militaristic, but the ratio of bark to bite seems a lot higher. But, you know, we just saw the Senate vote to join the House in a resolution of disapproval for the National Emergency Declaration. You're not seeing most of the checks come from Congress, though. To a certain extent, you're seeing them come within the federal bureaucracy itself, another place you're seeing them come from the judiciary. Perhaps the judiciary, is an example of the Madisonian system work. Another thing that, we were talking a minute ago about ambition counteracting ambition and whether Congress has the incentive to guard its own turf. It does seem to work out better and more like Madison envisioned when it comes to when you have divided government. So you see now with the Democratic House, you're seeing a lot more investigations. You're seeing a lot more supervising of and oversight of the executive branch, and the faction which he for good reasons distrusted, was not happy to see develop, even though he played a role in it. Faction does have this tendency, when the alignment is right, to make the Madisonian system function in more like the way Madison seems to have envisioned.
I think divided government is a really key thing to throw into this. I think one of the reasons we have a Democratic Congress is that a lot of people in a lot of swing districts who had Republican representatives, 40 of them, many of those districts voted for Donald Trump, but the people came to conclude he needed a check, and they went out 2 years later and voted for the opposite party just to be a check on the power of the presidency. And I'm not always in favor of that when it happens, because I think it's often done just because of how slow the recovery is or something like that, and it ends up leading toward a stasis that makes it very hard for government to do anything. But having said that, I think this last election was clearly a check and balance election, and I think we've seen other ones like that. And when the Congress is divided, or at least one of the houses is divided, you see much more of that branch of the legislature reasserting its prerogatives.
There's a thing here that I think needs to be noticed, which is that the whole system and its Madison system is hard to operate, as you well know. And it really requires a consensus. It's not one majority, one election. It's several majorities in several different kinds of districts at different times to get a workable government together, to get legislation through. So it requires a consensus and a persistence. And in a way, that seems like an act of genius for such a big country. But now you often read here over the time I've been here at Cato for the last two decades, not just in the last few months, that people, you see a lot of that's called gridlock. It's talked about as it's a malfunction. It's not, I mean, what it does mean is the bet was by the founders that if you can't have that consensus, then you do nothing. It's better to have the consensus than do something with a bare majority. But you sense from the culture, maybe just from the media, and to some degree from the people, the voters, that they really see it as, it's if something has a majority, it should be passed. And that's not the way the system's designed.
Well, I think there's something in the system that does slow it down even more. And it wasn't in the Constitution. Madison didn't put it in there, and it's not Madisonian. That is the filibuster. And in addition to the filibuster, the multiple 60 vote points of order that there are in the Senate. Those are all artifacts of the Senate for different reasons at different times. Obviously, part of it being civil rights and slavery, but a lot of other reasons have led to the multiplication of 60 vote points of order. But now you need a much more difficult consensus than you ever had before. And you're also seeing something in the Electoral College, which was supposed to slow everything down, but it's really a ratification of that state's popular vote now. But now we have the Electoral College, which is probably not as representative of the popular vote as it was for most of the last 150 years. So we've had two elections in this century alone where the person who won the popular vote didn't win the Electoral College vote. So it may have swung to the point where government is a little harder to find consensus in than it was, and maybe it's not Madison's fault. It's something else in the system, especially, I think, the filibuster. So I do think there is a problem of when consensus is more or less reached, it's not therefore acted upon.
As someone who year in and year out more often prefers that nothing gets done, depending on the alignment of political forces. I used to be a fan of the filibuster, but I think it also, we've seen in recent years how these extra veto points can lead to more concentration of power in the executive branch. I mean, I think that's exactly what's happened in immigration. They're close to enough votes to pass the DREAM Act, then they don't. And Obama, who had previously said he didn't have the power to do this by executive fiat, does DACA and DAPA, and then you get a new president and he tries to overturn it, and we're in court over that. That's really not the way the system is supposed to work. And in cases like that, the inability to actually get something that you've got, essentially a legislative majority for, tends to provide the executive branch with incentive to step out on its own and govern in a way that is not envisioned in our Constitution.
Mike mentioned the so-called Electoral College, the way we elect the president. Madison thought that he didn't like what you ended up with particularly, but he did endorse it particularly as he got older. And he saw it as a sort of way of bringing together two different – it was a mixed form of representation. The states had a role and the popular vote had a role. And there's other things like that, but that was like that. And so the president would be part of that. But, now it's very clear. A lot of people believe there's a federalism component, but actually the state role is because of political parties, because you adopted the rule of winner take all, because of a lot of things, right? The state role is really formal, but it really doesn't play a role in protecting state prerogatives. I mean, that didn't persist over time. American people, in a way, voted against it. They voted against indirect election of the Senate, too, right? So the states have become weaker in that sense, but it's very much against, I think, what Madison's expectations would have been, say, even as late as 1830, right, what the Electoral College would be like that. But it also strikes me that you and I have talked about a lot over the years about various things and about Madison, but we never talked about the Electoral College and what you think about it, whether you think it serves for liberty enhancing or is it just sort of a chaotic system?
I don't have a strong opinion about it. I mean, my sense is that it was originally supposed to, serve this saucer that cools sort of function. You'd get a lot of eminent worthies, to pick very early on, as I recall, the choice of electors becomes democratized, and certainly presidential selection starts to evolve very quickly away from the way that the framers thought it would, so I don't really have strong feelings about it one way or the other. Although if it does turn out that we do see increasing numbers of presidential elections, as we seem to have been, where the popular vote and the Electoral College are at odds, that seems like something that is going to give us quite a bit of trouble.
So as we draw near the end here, I wanted to discuss something that's a little less pleasant about Madison and as we hear it at his birthday, but I think it's interesting to me and interesting, I've thought about it often, which is the question of slavery. Now, Madison owned slaves and so on, but I want to start with another, everyone knows that, and that was a shameful fact. But Madison says in the Federalist Papers, he's at one point near the end of one of them, he sort of says people come up to you and say, well, and clearly this had happened to him, right? And they say to you, why is it that you still got – why did you keep the slave trade alive for another 20 years? Why didn't you just get rid of it, right, right now in 1789? And he gives his answer. He says the answer basically is, well, we would have, but it actually was the best we could do. And by what he meant by that – the circumstances, that there were states who were willing to bust up any kind of unionizing attempt, any kind of union, or the Constitution itself. They would withdraw from it, and South Carolina being the leading state here. And in essence, we chose that they had a veto on us, and we negotiated these constraints on it. They couldn't have it for in perpetuity, but that's what happened. It was a deal. So this is Madison, the deal maker, justifying the deal. The next alternative is a really bad alternative, apparently, that the union doesn't exist.
So a really bad alternative?
That's the question. That's one question, I think. Did they make the wrong deal? They clearly – that's Madison's justification. He clearly believed it. But was it the did they just delay what would have happened earlier? But in retrospect, we know what happened. They had one thing Madison might have believed at that point is that slavery was, because we're still pre-cotton gin, which resuscitates and revitalizes slavery as an institution, he could still believe, not totally implausibly, as many people did, that this was an economic institution that would slowly die, right? So you can say that. But there's really a political argument here that does say the union trumps the other. The other is how, this man was a real – at the beginning I talked about his achievements. This man was really a high achievement person. He was part of a lot of things and he came up with interesting ideas. And yet on the question of slavery to the country, he is basically useless for the next – in 1820 – Jefferson says, alarm bell in the night. They became aware, if not earlier, that slavery threatens everything we've done, right? And for that next 15 years or whatever in his post-presidential years, Madison doesn't come up with ideas that are plausible.
Well, I, first of all, I think in 1819, when he leaves the presidency, he actually does come up with a series of proposals to stop the expansion of slavery and hope that it swings back. But I think you're right in pointing out the cotton gin is a key moment. And at the time of the founding, Madison, Jefferson, Washington, they all know this is something that's completely at odds with what they've been arguing for. They know it's wrong. We have myriad quotes and discussions of it. There's a heated discussion in the Continental Congress itself or in the Constitutional Convention itself about this. Luther Martin of Maryland calls it an odious sin. And then John Rutledge of South Carolina and others. South Carolina and Georgia really leads the fight. What's interesting about Virginia and Maryland is that the tobacco industry is sort of going down, and all of a sudden the economics of slavery seems to be less exciting. And so you have the two things happening at once. One, people saying, I'd be better off with just paid wage workers. I think it's a bad idea. And then a bunch of other people saying, this is wrong. I had no idea it was wrong. I spent my life taking it for granted. It's completely at odds with the revolution. George Washington makes sure that all of his slaves are freed when he dies because this is something that's untenable. Jefferson, Madison, they all have debts. So they, even when they know it's wrong in their personal lives, they sell slaves in order to get money. I mean, it's really tawdry and disgraceful. But he has a very close relationship with a couple of slaves, and he gives them a lot of authority on his plantation, and he treats them similar to white overseers. So he knows they're human beings, and that's a critical point. And when he discusses the three-fifths rule, he talks about them, well, it's because they are human beings, but they're also, they're like property, but they're not like property that's inanimate or animal. So he knows this is completely and totally wrong, but it's the deal. The three-fifths rule is the deal. They can't get a union, they think. There are people who believe that Indian wars were so difficult on the South Carolina and Georgia borders that they could have gotten South Carolina and Georgia to come along. But I think it's an open question, Gene. Would have been better? We would have had 13 fractious, nation states at each other's throats. And who knows? It wouldn't have gotten rid of slavery in the South. So, and even remember, there was slavery in the North. Mm-hmm. So the other thing about Madison is he's very attracted to the idea of gradually moving toward emancipation and then exporting a lot of people to Africa.
Yes.
And African colonization. Yeah, isn't he in African colonization movement?
He is. And so this is the American original sin. It's a nightmare. One last thing I think worth talking about, Sean Wilentz has a whole book on this subject, just came out. He works very hard to make sure there's no phrase in the Constitution that legitimates property in man.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about people who are in labor relationships or periods of servitude or whatever, so that it could include a variety of different indentured servitude or slavery. But he doesn't talk about property in man. And that becomes important for later generations to hold on to as the abolition movement fights slavery.
But I think your point is a good one about Madison. And, obviously, he didn't act as we wish he didn't come up with any great ideas. But to me, part of the story of America is Dred Scott versus Sanford. Chief Justice Taney in there ascribes a number of different points of view about slaves and about slavery to the founding generation because he's sort of interpreting the Constitution. And basically one of the claims is that the founders thought these people were animals that had no more claim to rights than anyone. They had no rights you had to respect in that infamous phrase. And if we see Madison as you've described it, and I think that's correct, it's not great, but it is, Taney is wrong about it. It's wrong about the father of the Constitution, right?
Well, there is a fugitive slave clause in the Constitution, and there's a fugitive slave act that passed in 1850, I think. You guys would know better than I. It's not my area. And But Taney's rhetoric is disgraceful.
Yes.
And
shocking,
shocking
to the current students.
And he's the nation's first Catholic justice, so it's really very sad in that regard. A great hero in Maryland because of that, which was a Catholic colony. But it's really quite disgraceful. His rhetoric went way beyond the reality. And I guess it's just simply fair to say that the founders were not monolithic on this subject, and it wasn't just divided North and South. And there was a real opening for an abolition movement at the time of the Revolution before the cotton gin. Once the cotton gin comes into place, the value of slavery is too great, and the states that from where it's no value, the sale of their slaves, their enslaved people, right? These are human beings that are enslaved and they're treated like commodities, and it's a terrible stain on our society. And the cotton gin changes takes the interest part out of the equation, changes it dramatically. So they missed the opportunity.
So let's finish up with one last question. So it's 268 years ago he was born, and his birthday is here in March. Do we, each of you, do we appreciate Madison enough, or is he a founder that is overlooked too often? Do we, you know, we're doing our part here with a podcast, but do you think he has enough attention, enough fame now? Gene?
Well, he doesn't have his own Broadway musical.
That's true. He got the library, too.
No, I think Madison gets a lot of well-deserved attention. I mean, he's somebody that we devote a lot of thought to. I think, you know, we should also be feel free to criticize his handiwork. Too often people, I think, he's that line, is it in Federalist 10? I can't remember, about veneration, you know, blind veneration of antiquity. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we put him on a pedestal and we take for granted that our Constitution is working as it should, and everything about it was a brilliant design. And I think there are reasons to question that, and not to add a note of negativity on Madison's birthday. To end on a positive note, I did say that he wasn't a terrific president. There's at least one exception to that. He, in the midst of a war that is on American soil, that involves the burning of the White House, the Capitol, much of Washington, D.C. The historical record of him violating civil liberties, his record is pretty clean as far as that goes. There were a number of cases. This came up in some of our enemy combatant cases. This is in one of Justice Scalia's opinions, dissenting in the Hamdi case, about whether you can hold an American citizen as an enemy combatant. And Scalia says you can't. This is the worst power an executive can have. One of the things he cites is some work that's been done recently by a Vanderbilt law professor. About the article is called James Madison's Forgotten War, and she talks about how there are a number of cases where in one particular case the military arrested a U.S. citizen suspected of feeding information to the British, and a New York judge said you can't hold them on that. The military has no power to hold the citizen as a traitor. They order him released, and Madison follows the order. So for a war that, we probably shouldn't have fought, and that was provided every incentive for a massive crackdown on civil liberties, Madison comes out of that record comes out of that experience pretty clean.
For someone who wrote the two greatest Federalist Papers, who didn't venerate them, by the way, later when he talks about what American texts should be studied in colleges. This is like 15 years later. He says the Declaration. He lists a whole lot of other things. He says, and the Federalists are worthwhile looking at as well, although they're not always correct. So he doesn't venerate them. And a person who is the father of the, in many ways, the father of the Bill of Rights, and who, and I think this is a really important point that Gene's made, who as president tried to live as close to the values of republicanism as he could and still administer the war, execute the war, even at a time when it was failing. That's a pretty doggone good legacy to live on. And for all of his faults, he was a giant of the founding generation. And for all of the founding generation's faults, they have served us in mostly well. Obviously, slavery and the extermination of Indians is the two huge, massive stains. But they left us with something really to build for us and for the world.
I'm going to agree with that, but I'm going to say, you know, the best way to venerate Madison, I think we don't do enough, which is to take a Madisonian way of approaching politics, institutions, the Constitution, and all of our disagreements. I mean, when you think about Madison, what is he? He's concrete. He's practical minded. He's aware that theory matters, but he's also, you know, he doesn't want to let that get out of hand. He knows there are disagreements, but he's also got the idea that the problem is you've got to make this thing stable. He's aware of the fragility of democracy and republicanism in a way that we just completely take for granted. I think, you know, buildings and all of this stuff are something Washington lives on, Washington, D.C., but I'd like to see a much more Madisonian approach to things, more Madisonians out there who have different views about various things, but that kind of concreteness and approach, and also historically informed, right? He reads history the 3 years before the convention. We've lost some of that, and some of that's an abstract, the sort of deep disagreements that we read about all the time. These things are caused by a lack of a Madisonian spirit, I would think.
Thanks for listening. Free Thoughts is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.